Okay, I have handed out homework three on paper. Now, y'all are going to think it's weird because you only got like part of your homework three back, unless you sent me a web page. But if you sent me a spreadsheet, I didn't print every single part of the spreadsheet just to tell you how wonderful every single part of your spreadsheet was. If you made a mistake, I printed out the part where you made a mistake, so I could circle it, right? So presumably if I didn't print something out, it's fine. If you didn't make a mistake, I randomly selected something to print out. Now, you will be amazed to know what the most common mistake was on the homework. You'll just be flabbergasted. You would not expect this in graduate school. Failure to put your name on the assignment, right? So, I mean, I knew where I got it from, but when I wanted to hand it back to you, I had to actually write your name on the file because we all think so electronically, right? So, you know, we think that it must be embedded in there someplace. Anyhow, so I wrote your name on it and handed it back to you. If you have questions, here's how the grading was done. If you made one stupid mistake, it didn't count against you. If you made two stupid mistakes, I thought, well, probably you didn't have the big picture here, it counted against you. No matter how many mistakes you made, it couldn't count against you more than 1 point. So you get like 4 points for good serious effort and 1 point for astounding success. It turned out that nobody was, you know, sort of nowhere in the neighborhood. Everybody was very close. There were a few people who didn't quite have, like, you know, whether three was bigger than two or, you know, those sort of basic math things. There was nobody that was looking at this going, huh? So that was great. I mean, everybody earned the 4 or 5 that they got. And in almost every case where somebody got a five for a stupid mistake, you look at it and go, that's a really stupid mistake. I mean, it's not a lack of understanding mistake. That's a, you know, not being awake at 3 a.m. kind of mistake. Okay, so that's the homework. If anyone has any questions about the last homework, I'm happy to answer it. Probably best to do those things, privately, because there were a small number of people that had the middle sorts of creative different kinds of mistakes. Elephant, you.
Do you want me to reformat so you can print it?
No.
Oh.
No, I don't really want to print it. I'm happy to look at them on screen. I just had to have some place to write down your grade. Right? That's the only reason I come back to the class. Okay. The next homework seems to have generated a little interest. So we'll talk about that in just a moment. But first, I want to introduce Yejun Wu, who's our teaching assistant. I want to say a few words about who you are, what you do.
My name is Yejun Wu. You can find a link from the course website to my homepage on which you can find my contact information. I will be working with you on your project. How many projects do we have? Two?
Whoa.
Okay, one. And the writing of the homework. Okay. My office is at 4128 at the Home Day Library.
And he responds to email instantly 24 hours a day.
That's impossible.
Try it.
I noticed that my email address on the website is wyjsgru.edu. Actually, can use wyjsgru.edu. Because if you send my email to Glue, then the Glue needs time, several hours, to transfer to my final email address. So if you probably need a quick answer, like within 2 or 3 hours, then you probably send it to my final email address.
And I'll update that.
Okay, yeah. But that email is okay. Sure, that works.
Any questions for Yejun? He's just on a drop by so that you can see who he is and where to find him. Good. Thank you. Okay. We also have Dr. Jen Volbeck. Jen is an expert in the semantic web. Later in the class, after we talk about the unsemantic web, the plain, boring web, then
the old web.
The old web, right. The one that's almost a decade old. We still think it was like, 3 yards of road. I'll tell you about the old web. Jim will tell you about the exciting new semantic web. We've got a exercise for you in which you will envision an actual real working semantic web, or you will try to spam an actual real envisioned working semantic web. So you should start deciding whether you want to be nice or evil, because we're going to give one spammer to each group. So think about which side of that game you want to be on. So Jen will be with us through the entire class, and hopefully we'll jump in if I screw anything up and correct me or ask a polite question that will cause me to say, oh wait, I have no idea what I'm talking about. Okay, and that's one of the great things about guest speakers in the class is they keep us all. Okay, and by the way, you can take any one of the seats if you want.
Oh, everybody's here?
Yep.
I don't want to throw off
the
equilibrium.
No. In fact, establishing a little disequilibrium is a good thing. So I put off the due dates for the second, or for the last assignment, for the fourth assignment, the last individual assignment. And had I been thinking at the beginning of the semester, I would have done that. In fact, as somebody pointed out to me, I actually thought I had done that. I thought it was 2 weeks in advance, because at one point in some draft syllabus, it had been that way. The timing of all of these things is set up so that you don't get everything due on the last day of the semester, right? That's the main reason to spread things out. And so I certainly don't mind moving it back to tomorrow evening at 11:30. The time is ticked so that we can talk about any questions you have today. And then, even if you have another class tomorrow night, sometime in there you can find a few minutes without answers, right? Without it running into the stuff that you have to do. Somebody also pointed out to me that there's this nice note in the description of the group assignment that's due next week that says that more details on this will appear before the beginning of the semester. Now, it didn't say which semester. I want to point that out to my friends. But in any case, somebody asked and said, gee, is it past the beginning of the semester yet? And I was like, oh, you really need to get that one up. So in any case, that's there now. You should have had a chance to look at it, but we'll talk about that too. And one of the groups has been good enough to provide an example. So you have, in addition to guidelines, an example to work from. The assignments due after that is due 2 weeks after that. So a week from now, 2 weeks in advance of that assignment, I will have the details of that assignment up, and I'll say 2 weeks ahead. And I never mind being told when I do it. So somebody sent me a very nice message. I looked at previous semesters, I'm looking for guidance on this, and I'm like, yep, send me a note, I'll ask straight enough. Right? And we'll get it straight now. So, shall we do first questions on the assignment? The wolf's closest.
Does that mean that you don't want us to post it until tomorrow evening?
I actually don't care now if you post it before tomorrow evening, because I don't want to require everybody to be up at 11:30 to post it instantaneously at the same time. Just be good. Don't look at everybody else's assignment until you finish your own. Okay?
Oh, just to be clear, it's due tomorrow night?
Tomorrow night.
You email said Tuesday.
Says what?
Tuesday.
I can't win. Damn, tomorrow.
I wasn't going to reply. It's October 16th, so I thought that was clear enough.
It's due tomorrow night. But surely there must be real questions, right? That's very much. You put it off, you could have all done it by now. No questions. Everybody's happy, right? You understand what the assignment's about. The biggest questions I've gotten so far are on cooling. And the reason why I'm getting questions on cooling is because this is actually not the way we do it in reality. If we did it the way we did it in reality, it would have made perfect sense. But we're doing a little bit backwards. So let me tell you reality, and then what's different here, and see if that takes something that was previously clear and makes it less clear, or vice versa. Okay. So here's what happens. I want to know all the relevant documents in the world, right? All the relevant documents for one topic. So what I do is I have everybody go search for that topic and tell me what they think is relevant. I put those all together, and I don't know which ones are relevant. I just know what they thought was relevant. I put them together, and I send them off to a judge who checks the relevant ones and puts an X by the number. Right? I got a 1 or a 0 out of the judge. Right? So I pull them and then judge them. And this allows me to judge them without knowing which system they came from. I can sort them in alphabetical order. It's nice and fair. There's no possibility of bias. Right? I get an independent judge, preferably the judge who came up with the question, so the experimenters don't bias this in any way. Right? You understand? Cool. Now I know almost every relevant document in the world. Of course, my process isn't perfect. It might not find them all, but I know a lot of them. And I'll just assume that's all of them. Then you come up with a system. Now, don't think too hard about where the system came from. You come up with a system, it gives me a rank list, I know which ones are relevant, I'll score your rank list. You come up with a system, I'll score your rank list. I'll score anybody's rank list, right? I'm not picky. Okay? Now, it turns out the rank lists I'm scoring are the ones that contributed to the pools in the first place. But you don't have to think about that. You can just put them all together, get them scored, and then present any rank list, including the ones that originally contributed. Make sense? Now, what's different in what we actually did here? We took a set of judgments for each system where we already have the judgments. We did the pooling, and presto, we have the pooled judgments. Then we present a rank list for you, and now we have people asking questions like, well, wait a minute, if I'm evaluating precision at 10, do I only pool down to 10? Which is not a bad question from the perspective of the list you happen to have, but that's not the way the real process worked. The way the real process worked was, you pool everything you have, find out everything you can find, and then I give you a rank list and we'll score it. Yes? So, if we want to score it by precision at 10, that's fine, we can do that, but it doesn't change the way you pool, because the pooling is done before you start scoring the list. Does that make sense? Okay. Does that leave any questions? The reason for putting off the homework is because you were supposed to have questions.
What the precision means for calculating the precision in both Google and Telma, pooling even does not matter, right?
Right. Excellent point. So, if I want to calculate precision, so a student came to me before class and said, one of those things was perfect. Either precision or recall. I can't remember which one it was. Alright? So this is exactly what the point is. You want to have a command of the idea, not necessarily remember the formula. And so the idea of precision is, I have something in front of me. How good is it? Alright? That can't be affected by my knowledge of the rest of the world. My idea of recall is, there's a lot of stuff out there in the world. How much of it did I find? Oh, if I learn more about the world, I might change my opinion on how much I found. Right? So precision can't be affected by pooling because it's a question about what's in front of me. Recall can. Yes. That's an excellent question. And it points out what we're trying to learn here. If every time you hear this question, the question about precision or recall, you have to go back to the formula, you'll keep getting it backwards. I used to keep getting it backwards ever because, I mean, look at what's the formula? It's relevant retrieved over relevant, or relevant retrieved over retrieved. Those sound really similar, right? The brain doesn't do too well at that. So what you really want is a picture in your mind's eye that says, precision is the thing I'm looking at the screen, how good is it, just judged internally. And then the formula helps you understand what that means. Okay? Other questions? Sure.
Just that when figuring out recall, just think there's one slide that shows measuring precision and recall from the last class, and it says assume that there are a total of 14 relevant documents. So in this case, we also have to make an assumption about the number of relevant documents to be part of this as well. Is that correct, or does that not even come into play on this?
For recall, that's exactly right.
Okay.
And the question's worded in a way that will cause you to make different assumptions. The first assumption is we're going to do polling, and once we complete our polling, what we've discovered is every relevant document that exists. Okay? It's not true. This is what we assume. Right?
Okay, so we assume that our pool shows is every relevant document that exists?
For the purpose of calculating the formula.
Okay.
Then we get a number that would be the number if that was every relevant document. Okay. Then there's this nasty question at the end. There's always these nasty questions at the end of the assignment. It says, what kind of assumptions have we made? Not like I just gave it away, but we've made some assumptions. What's their effect? Right. So that's sort of the thought problem. Then. What was the effect of having made that assumption? So there you can't say, oh, well, he's always made the assumption. So there now, all of a sudden, that assumption's open in question. Okay? Other questions? Okay. Are there questions about the assignment that's due next week? The functional specification. Think about that. Ask at the end of class. All right. So what do we do this week? Well, here's the setup of the entire class, the entire course. First, I tell you everything you need to know in order to get a text retrieval system to work. What the text retrieval system does is it takes what somebody called today for me, a closed collection. Right? Just, here, look, it's on my hard drive, or I just handed you a DVD. Right? I've got this collection, searching. Right? And all it's got in it is words in English. Yeah? And the query is going to come in English. So we simplify the problem just as much as we can. And you can see we could still figure out how to spend a month and a half talking about that problem. Now, what we do is we say, was it really the problem? The real problem is the web. Okay, so we'll solve that problem tonight. Then we'll say, that wasn't really the problem. The real problem is it's the World Wide Web and they don't speak English all the time. All right? So, okay, we'll solve that problem. That turns out that's not the problem. The real problem is they keep scanning documents and putting them on the World Wide Web. Okay, we'll solve the scan documents problem. But that's not really the problem. The real problem is that there are all of these speeches on the World Wide Web. Okay, we'll solve that problem. But that's not really the problem. The problem is we've got performance art. We've got, like, dance. Right? What are we going to do now? Here's my query. Okay. We actually will do that. Right? We'll get to the point where we won't actually query by dancing, but we will actually query songs by whistling. Right? So that's where we're going. While you're doing your project, we're going to say, look, here's some other problem we haven't thought of yet. How do we solve it? And it will turn out that the solution to those problems will all have exactly the same structure that we've talked about so far. Right? Except that the information will have different characteristics, users will have different abilities, and therefore the system will have to have a slightly different design. Right? With the same decomposition, but implemented somewhat differently. So the first place we run into that is the web. Sooner or later, that's why it will work. Okay. So, does anybody know when the web started? Yes, ma'am.
1991.
And what does that mean? What happened in 1991?
Tim Berners-Lee, guy with the bachelor's degree sitting at CERN, made a browser and a little language.
So the web is a browser and a protocol.
And a language for making pages.
And a language for making pages. The browser, a protocol, a language for making pages, now I got a web. even before I have a page. He didn't have to make a page, but we had a web before there was a web page.
I suppose you could argue it, but I'd say no.
Okay. So, I'll argue.
I'm shocked.
Here's my claim. The web was caused by cheap disks. You might have seen that someone got the Nobel Prize in, what was it, physics, for making disks that would fit in your iPod. That guy caused the web. Because if the disk weren't cheap, I'll be damned if I'm going to let you put your information on my server. You want to store the information, you store it on your server, and you pay for the disk. Because I'm paying for the disk, and you're using it. So the disk better be cheap, right? Otherwise, I'm not going to let you do that. I'm going to care. The web comes from don't care on disk prices. If we cared, no web. That's not enough, of course. The web comes from being able to send the stuff from me to you very quickly. We could have the protocol. These people could be sitting there drinking coffee in Switzerland. But nobody would use it if you had to pay a lot for the connection. But you might have heard that the internet is free. It's not really free. It's paid for by subscription. But the subscription costs are relatively low. And so you can buy sort of a share in the internet. Now, by 1995, you could buy, or you could move 25,000 requests for web pages at the same time over the backbone of the internet. 25,000 different people could click all at the same time. If you go back long before that, you couldn't have moved all of this data through the net very easily. You'd be sitting here clicking and wait, put that loss in. Remember in the old days when you click it, it was like nothing happened. And you had to click again because the clicks went through a protocol that was not robust to loss packets. Okay, so we had to get an internet or no web. Somehow I had to be able to get the stuff through the phone line to you. Otherwise, the only people that have the web would be sitting there at higher ed physics labs in Switzerland, right? So for there to be a web, there has to be a producer of the information, a consumer of the information. Where are the consumers of the information? Well, initially, they were in university campuses, right? But after a while, they were at home. So this was the year, 1995, in which you could get a modem so fast that you could send one entire string full of text through that modem in 1 second. So you could actually see the results of clicking on something while sitting at home, as long as there were no images. But of course, what really sold the web was the images. And it turned out that in 1994, 5% of the US population had a computer that could display images. Think back to the old PCs back then. They didn't all come with graphics cards. Graphics cards were a big deal. The reason we talk about graphics cards was because you had to put one into your computer. So the original computers were mostly tech. But in 1994, 5%. In 1995, 10%. In 1996, 20% of the computers in the U.S. had the ability to display images on the screen. And so the image part of the web could be wired together, too. None of those were sufficient to cause the web that we know today to come into existence, because what happened was it all made the web a little bit bigger, which made the web a little bit harder to find things on the web. And so what really allowed the web to take off to the size we know today was two developments, both of which occurred in 1994, both of which reached the marketplace in 1995. One was a group of people who sat around and said, you know, if we could just find all the web pages and put them in categories, we could start a company and make a mint. And they were wrong. I mean, they could start a company and make a mint, but it was kind of useless. It was the wrong way to do it, because it too ran into scale limitations. And there were another group of people here at CMU that said, hey, if we could just make a search engine that would pick words and find the things that have the words on the page, we can handle a web of any size and produce really lousy searches for people, right? And so they did, and they were wrong too. print, so they founded a company called Lycos, and that didn't work out either. But not because it wasn't the right idea, just because it took a couple more companies before people got a good business model for this, right? So that you could make money doing it. So my claim is, these things all happened by accident, and the guy with the coffee and CERN happened by accident. They were called forth, right, by the things that were going on in the world, and this makes the web, is the ability to search. Because you can't have a web at scale if you can't do it. Then finding something is the first step in doing something with it. And as Ken will tell you, the last step, the first step. Okay, so here is one particular version of the web, right? It's HTTP, HTML, and URL. Oh, got a web. Well, we can make a browser. So if I show you a web page, you can tell me it's a web page, right? Feels like a web page, looks like a web page, right? Your homework's on the web, but your homework's not in HTML. It was all in this funny Excel thing, right? Is that the web? Like Excel, is it on the web?
No.
What's that?
No.
Now it is, yeah? So I was watching NASA TV last time they flew the astronauts in orbit. Is that the web? I mean, I went to a web page and I clicked on Show Me NASA TV, and NASA TV came up on my screen. It's streaming video, though, right? It isn't any place. It's like the moving hand having grit move on, right? There's nothing there. There's no there, right? It's like television, after they say it, it's gone. It's an ether. Right? Is that the web? Because when you talk about searching the web, you're going to have some idea of what it is you're searching. Okay. And then we made this distinction between, there's the public web, and we've got an intranet now, which is, what needs to be an intranet is it means that this stuff, except nobody else can use it. Right, so it's all the web technologies, except it's a restricted access. Is that the web? Or am I just using web technology? Okay, so we're not going to answer to any of these things. And we'll just make it worse. Now that you know what the web is, what's a website? I mean, so this is a study at OCLC that they did back in 2002 or 2003, and you can see the number of websites is going up, and by their study methodology seems to be leveling off. So, what's a website? I mean, what's that?
Well, it's not the limited domain.
So, like umd.edu, be a website?
Oh.
No. So, your website is different from my website, even though they're both at umd.edu? You see how this is a problem even figuring out? I mean, we probably shouldn't try to count websites, right? Because we'll just get into big arguments about what a website is. Is the Hotmail a website? Any websites?
Is that kind of like trying to define what a document is? So if you have a book that's got a collection of papers written by individual authors, is the book the document, or is each of the papers the document?
Yeah. Exactly. So what is a little bit more useful is to try to count web pages, because they've got a beginning and an end, right? They've got a head and a body, and you kind of think of them. I mean, they're just files, right? So you don't know how many files there are. So in 2005, which is the most recent study I could find, they're counting billions of pages. And this is kind of a nice study because it talks about what it is we're doing. So here's how big they thought the web was, almost 12 billion pages. This is how many pages Google indexes, 8 billion. And if you ask Google at that time how many they indexed, they tell you 8.1 billion. So that's about what they're indexing. And Yahoo was indexing less than Google at that time. And so Yahoo gave up on this, take a listen to everything on the web thing, you can see why. And they went to just being another search engine. So it looks like Yahoo is indexing less, but actually they're not. Right? So this is misleading, because at the time, Google didn't index the whole page. Google only indexed the first 101 kilobytes on the page, and then they'd say, well, I'm sure the rest is quite a lot like the first 101 kilobytes, whereas Yahoo also wasn't indexing the whole page, but they were indexing the first 250 kilobytes on the page. So you can see if they both went out and bought the same number of disks, that Google was going to be able to hold more pages, even if they were both holding the same number of bytes. Right? So this is sort of a technology money limit here that is just being deployed in slightly different ways. Now the interesting number is, where does this indexed web come from? The answer is, it comes from exactly the same approach that we use for polling. So if I want to know how much stuff somebody indexes, all I do is I find out how much stuff these people index and what it is, what these people index, what these people index, what these people index, and I pull it. Right? So I just remove all the duplicates, exactly like we were talking about. Of course, we don't really check all 10 billion pages, right? We just sample the space and we see for a query how much of the stuff we get back from all the different search engines is the same, count it once, find out how much is different, count it when we see it. Right? It's full. Then, to get this, what you do is you say, probably about 20% more. There's some scientific way of doing that, but you get the idea. Anyway, so they don't really know. But you can see that, well, it's got to be more than this, right? There's probably one thing these people have found, so it's something more than this. We don't know how much more, but how about that? Right? Under all of it. So that's where that comes. Okay, so our problem is, we have to go search 11.5 billion pages. Now, where do you find 11.5 billion pages? I mean, nobody will deliver the pages. I mean, they will if you ask for them. You just know the URL. We didn't get the URL. So what? How would you get the URLs for every page on the web? What would you do?
You're supposed to be registered with the central agency.
So that will find me the servers. If I go to ICANN, the Internet something or other for name something or others. All right? So I found the servers now. How do I find your page on the umd.edu? How do I find the homework page? How do I find that Excel spreadsheet? How do I find every single URL? Not the server. I want to find the page.
There are programs called crawlers, Roberts.
Follow the links. With a crawl.
Domain. Domain name server.
Well, that will get me the server.
Yeah. The domain name is searched by the domain server, and each domain server communicates each other that where the intended page is.
If I know the URL. Oh. If I don't know if I don't know what to ask for, just imagine yourself, I mean, this is the guys who started Google, I actually met those guys, right, Brent and Paige. I went to a conference at Berkeley, and I had a chance to, just sort of wander down the hall and see them demonstrating something they were doing. They come over from Stanford for this. And everybody's saying, my goodness, most of the stuff we make, I don't really use. But this thing I use, and I thought, okay, that's interesting. But they were all very altruistic at the time, because what they noticed was that the search engine companies wouldn't give away their crawls. So they had to go crawl it themselves. And at one point they actually used up half of Stanford's internet, which got a few phone calls to them. And then they started crawling places they weren't supposed to crawl, which got a few more phone calls, which didn't go to them because of the president of Stanford. So they became real famous even before they became rich. So how did they do this? They didn't, and just imagine the problem. You're sitting at Stanford and you want all the world's information. So what do? You just jump. Hey, if you got something, send it, okay? Where do you get the URL? So you said crawling. So tell me how it works. What do I do?
It's a program which scouts the domain servers with the HTML links and pages, and it follows them, and it makes.
Where does it get the first one? I mean, I know what it does second, right? But what does it do first?
You pick.
You pick something. Okay,
Settled on the Stanford homepage.
Here's what we picked something, right? We picked the Stanford homepage, we picked Bryn's page, we picked Paige's page. Yeah? Right? So that's what we did. Then we just followed. Okay, so this page turns out to be linked to these two pages. So we'll just, this page is linked to these two pages, now we know about these three pages. Does this look a lot like pooling to you? We're just taking all the URLs on all the pages we found and pooling them. That's what we're doing. This page is linked to that page. These pages are linked to these pages. So on and so forth. Get the idea? How's the 11 doing?
So if another links to your site, you're kind of in luck.
You won't be linked. You won't be indexed, right? How will Google know you're there? Tree falls in the forest and there's nobody there to hear us, right?
Well, I remember how Yahoo, you used to be able to like submit your domain.
So you could register your domain.
Right.
Here's another way they could do it. The University of Maryland publishes the most popular domains at umd.edu. So you could put up something popular, tell all your friends, they could tell all their friends, and after a while it shows up on the most popular page, which is known by Google and Yahoo.
Doesn't also the HTML or HTTP protocol track referral URLs? So when you go to one page, another always knows what page you came from.
Always is too strong here, but your browser, in a request, raps on you and tells the next site what the last site was. Okay. So that people can put together pieces of the graph that might not be visible because they can see backwards through this. Okay, so use all these tricks to figure it out. Here's the basic algorithm, the extremely simple version. You put a set of known sites on a queue. So a queue is something where you pop things in, and then you can take things out, either the same side or the other side. So we're going to repeat this until the queue is empty. We take something off the queue. We check to see if that page has been processed before. So we take the URL off the queue. If it hasn't been processed, we add the page to the index. We find every link on the page, we add them to the queue, do it again. Right? This is how they got in trouble. Right? Because what happens is if you do this, how quickly does it go after the next page? Well, why wait, right? I mean, now we know there's a page there to be had. Let's go get it too. So they managed to bring down several large internet servers by just hitting it with what looks an awful lot like a denial of service attack. Right? So we have to build in a little, let's not go back to the same server too often sort of a thing, and you know, so there is a whole sort of group of people that work on how to do this right. So one thing that became clear pretty early was that there were some people who were perfectly happy to put things up on the web and have people look at them, but they didn't want them indexed. They were there for their friends, not for the whole world. And so then there's this question. Is it legal to index a page that doesn't wish to be indexed? Right? Where in copyright law, or in patent law, or in trademark law, or any place you can find in the intellectual property law, does it say, I can't index your page? But we run into the same problem the other way around. Where does it say that I can? Isn't that your information? Aren't I taking your words and putting them in my index? Don't you own that? You could argue this one either way, right? In order to prevent lawsuits on this, the World Wide Web Consortium got together and said, hey, why don't we just agree that we'll all voluntarily comply with some protocol that we'll now make up? So these people in Switzerland, they come up with some protocol, add it to the web. The web's becoming more complicated now. So now I can exclude you from my site, right? I can, at the top level of my site, I can say which directories you're not allowed to crawl. Right? So you often find things that can't be crawled. Or I can exclude you just from my document by putting something in the document that says, you know, don't crawl me. So when you get there, you're supposed to look there and see if it's there. And not everybody follows this, you know. Google does, because otherwise they get a host of complaints that the CIA's web crawler doesn't have to follow this, right? If they have. And it would be different from Google's web crawler.
I wonder why Google's free.
Exactly. Okay. So, Andre Broder went out, and it turned out that people had been drawing what these networks looked like as they grew for some time without having heard of the web. They studied how graphs of human interconnections worked, these so-called small world networks. And they seem to all have this kind of a structure. And so I went out to with a question, does the web have this structure? Sure enough, it does. So this is what you think of as the web. These are, at the time he did this, 56 million pages that were all connected to each other with, you know, sort of 6 degrees of separation, right? You can get from one of these pages to another page with just a few clicks, right? And no matter where you started, you can get to any other page in here with just a few clicks. Now, there were some pages that you could get to from here with just a few clicks, but you couldn't get back. These pages point at that, but these don't point at that, right? Anything that occurs naturally will have this characteristic. It's a bunch of strongly interconnected stuff, and then there's a bunch of stuff that you can connect out to. Okay? You know, somebody knows about it, but it's not a very polite site, it's not very social, it doesn't connect out to anybody else. It's a destination. Right, so these are destinations. Then you have these people over here that don't have a life. They just sit here and make a list of things. Right? So this is what Yahoo was in the early days. Right? And they just make lists of things. And, you know, my 10 favorite kinds of hot dogs. Right? And then they point to those 10 hot dog pages. And, I mean, it's the stupidest list you've ever seen. So nobody points to it. Right? So you've got some people pointing into the strongly connected component. You got the people getting pointed out from the strongly connected component. In fact, some of these people pointed out some of those people. Okay. And then there are always these weird people out here who will point at these people, but nobody points at them. Right? So at least in here you can get around in here a little bit, but if you ever get out here, it's going forever. And these people point out to some stuff. You get the idea? And then your homework is right here. Nobody pointed at it, and it's not pointing at anybody. Right? So there's a whole lot of little islands sitting out there. So the web kind of looks like that. Not what you thought of, right? You were thinking Charlotte's Web? Okay. Now, a fair question is, do these people speak English? So this is old data, but these are the people on the internet. And when the internet started, the 31%, which is English, was almost all of it, never completely all of it, because like Tinbergen Lee probably has to be French or German or something. Okay. And then as time went on, this has gotten down to the point where the number of people speaking English, the percent of the population, is declining. Which is funny, because the absolute number is going up. Right? But look what's happening here in China, in Chinese, which back in 2004 was 18% of the population. This is a very small percent of the population in China, and that's virtually the entire English-speaking population of the world. Right? So what's going on here is there's growth potential here, and the growth potential in all these other languages is what's driving English down. Funny thing, though, is that nobody told the people to write the web pages. Right? So the people kept writing the web pages in what they could what they could write them in, which was originally English because that's what everybody wanted to see. So it's been going down too, it's down about here now, but it's not going down nearly as fast as the speakers are going down. But the reason for that is it's handy to have a language in which you can exchange information, a lingua franca. Right? Yeah.
Are those percentages, for example, very long percent, meaning you speak at least English?
This is a first language. Yes, so there are a whole lot more people who speak English than just the first language. Okay, so this tells you that it'd be good to be able to do a little bit of cross-language searching. And we'll get to that in a little while. Okay, so discovering islands and peninsulas in a web crawl is a problem. detecting duplicate content is a bigger problem than you would expect, because a third or more of the web is a duplicate of data that's on the web already. And this is not really a duplicate, because it has a different URL. But it's the same content. And this can be because multiple URLs point to one thing, like the server had aliases, or it could be because people thought your information was so cool that they decided to copy it and stick it on their server too. Or it could be because your information is so valuable that people do this intentionally, called mirroring. Okay, so you got to handle duplicate content. This is a lot of work in web search engines on this to get efficiency. I told you about this problem, right, bringing Stanford's expertise. This is the one that's going to drive us nuts tonight. This is where, in part, the semantic web comes from. Is that there's an awful lot of stuff on the web that isn't really actually on the web. When you ask for it, it's created for you and delivered over the web. Right? There's a course, INFM 718N, that you can take about how to dynamically create web pages out of databases that never existed before people asked the question, and as soon as it's sent to you, will never exist again. Right? So how do you index that? It's dynamically generated content. And then, well, the web's changing. And so it's changing at a pretty rapid clip. It changes at about 1% a week. And then, of course, if I crawl the web and I find a link and the link goes to some place that doesn't respond, and I just sort of say, okay, well, it's a dead link, well, it might be at a place where they just turn off the computer at night and you crawl it during the day. I actually had this happen. There was one group I was working with that had like wonderful data up in Greece, but when they went home at night, they turned off the computer, right? Which turned out to be during the day here. Right? So the only time you could find this stuff was like between 3 in the morning and 9 in the morning. It turns out there are no computer scientists up between 3 in the morning and 9. So anyhow, you have to design your web crawler so that it will try again, but that it has to try again at different times of the day. So this problem of duplicate detection, there are basically three different ways in which you can go after it. One way, which you might not have thought of initially, is let's say that I crawl a bunch of URLs and I find exactly the same directory tree. This very complex directory tree. And it's identical. I might guess, well, the whole directory tree's got the same information. It's just, it's the same subdirectory with a different name above it, right? An alias of the server. So that's one way to find it. A second is I can say, hey, this thing's got the same bytes as those things, right? Some sort of a low-level processing, you might call it syntactic, in an analogy to the way we think about language, the structure of language. You just think about the bytes. Or we did a project that was supposed to find translations, and we just looked to see if the markup was identical. The markup was identical, it was possibly a translation. So there are these simple things. Or you might have exactly identical content, except one of them is in KOI8 code, and the other one's in Unicode. Yeah. So those aren't changed at all. They look exactly the same to you, except that no two bytes are the same. Okay, so you have to account for all these things when you're doing web indexing. So here's the setup for the exercise later tonight.
Yeah. Well, just from like when you find duplicates, what do you do? Do you like just pick one and one index, or do you, as far as being able to retrieve which one gets? How do you pick which one gets?
So a very simple thing you can do is just pick one. If they're truly duplicates, it's okay to index either one. And for their URL, you just put in two different URLs, right? And then the search will find the pair of URLs and will know that they're equivalent to each other, at which point you can do anything you want in the interface. Okay, so if you're gonna be on the red team, so there's gonna be a blue team and a red team, the red team is the bad team. If you're going to be on the red team, you need to change the way you think about IR. I mean, think about it. Everything is a competition for ascension. Who gets to decide what the reader reads? Well, if you're a searcher, you control what comes to you, right? You are in control. If, on the other hand, you just walk into some store and you look around, like a bookstore, you see what they put out for you. They control what you see. So publishers are trying to control what you see, right? And it's in their interest that you should see things you might want to buy. Whereas it's in your interest to see what it is you wanted to find. So you don't have quite the same interest. I mean, we think censorship is a bad thing, right?
And the values are, we have to talk about values.
So we tend to think of censorship as a bad thing, but actually, search is merely user-controlled censorship. We just want to remove everything else on the web except the thing we wanted to find. That's it, right? It's just, it's suppression. We must have known about it, otherwise I couldn't have found it for you. So search is simply the removal of everything you didn't want to see. Right? So you're trying to remove it at the same time that the spammer is trying to get you to see what's in their interest for you to see. Now you have very limited time and attention, so you're sitting here trying to control it, right? And the search engine's trying to help you do that, whereas the spammer is sitting here trying to use up your time and attention on whatever benefits them. So here's how it works. Let's say I'm the bad guy, and I want you to see my page. Now, I want to find people who are looking for Volkswagens, and I want to show them Ferraris. Because who knows, I might get them to trade up, right? They're looking for a car. Now, they didn't ask for a Ferrari, they asked for a Volkswagen. But I'm going to show them a Ferrari because I don't have any Volkswagens, but I got Ferraris. Right? Okay. So here's what I do. I go and I add some invisible text. This is a blue font on a blue screen. And the text says, Volkswagen, 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 Volkswagen. Well, you saw how that'll work, right? I got a real high TF for Volkswagen. You come along, you search for Volkswagen, like, pick me, pick me. Okay? So, okay, we can't let that happen. So here's what we're going to do. We're going to agree that instead of searching based on the text that's in the document, we'll allow people to put in metadata that describes what the document's about, and then you can search based on the metadata. Well, you can guess how much easier this makes it for the spammer, right? I don't even have to make the text invisible. Right, I'll just stick it in the metadata field, and I'll say, this is a page about Volkswagen. And you're like, great, I'll show it to all the people that have for Volkswagen stuff. Like, okay, well, so that wasn't such a good idea. There are all sorts of things you can do like this. This is where Google came from. It came from that problem. So people are trying to figure out, I want to find the people who are talking about Volkswagens that other people think are authoritative sources. It's a standard concept from Library Science, right? So what did they use? Another standard concept from Library Science, citation indexing. So they wanted to find out who were the most highly cited authors of web pages. It's like, well, we don't really know who the authors are, but we have the direct citation to web pages. Let's find the most highly cited web pages. So they found, here's a web page that gets cited by this person. Okay, it's cited by two people. The problem is, what do I know about these people who cited it? It turns out they're spammers. They just bought a website and built a bunch of links to the places that they wanted Google to index. So it doesn't work. The original idea that they had was you count the number of links coming in, and that will tell you who the most authoritative sites are, and that fails. Because the spammers only have to go by a few sites, put a lot of pages on them, and link to the Ferrari page. Right? Okay. So, they ultimately came up with this one over here, which is a much better idea. And what they said was, look, so this gets linked to from this person here, but I got no clue whether they're any good. It gets linked to by this person here. I don't know about them either. But look at that. This one I got a little confidence in. Lots of people link to this one. This one links to them too. See that? So I earn credit by getting linked to, and then I can transfer that credit by linking to people. I mean, the classic example would be the original Yahoo page, which links to lots of people, and lots of people link to them. So it's an authoritative hub. It links to lots of people, it's a hub. Lots of people link to it, it's an authority, and the people linking to it are themselves authoritative. So here's what Green and Page figured out. So this wasn't any big deal. Everybody kind of knew that this could be done. They figured out how to calculate a score for every one of these pages, where that score would be the exact same score that you would get if you started at a random page and followed random links. It's where you would, it's the websites that would get the most traffic. Okay? And they figured out how to do that without actually having to simulate the bouncing around on the web. Much, much more efficiently. And that results in a numerical score for every page. Right? And then they had to come up with a name for it. And Sergey Brin, graduate of the University of Maryland, was holding out for Brin rank.
What?
Sergey Brin, right? You wanted Sergey rank? Right? Larry Page, on the other hand, came up with Page rank. Well, guess who won that battle? Okay? So this is where the Page rank algorithm came from. Right? Was this attempt to propagate authority conceptually, but to do it with an efficient enough implementation that you could actually compute a score across 12 billion web pages. I mean, they didn't have to do 12 billion web pages while they were at Stanford, but later they got more money on computers, and now they can do a score across 12 billion web pages. Okay? And that's the PageRank score. Okay. Now, if you have that, it becomes harder to spam, but then what happens is the spammers just have to become more clever. Okay. So that's not the end of the story, but it's sort of the middle. Okay. Okay, let's take a break here. We'll come back in 10 minutes, and I will show you the long-promised story of probabilistic representations in information retrieval, the language models, which turn out to be necessary because of paper. So it actually is a good spot to put it in. Thank you.
they show that they're clever.
So we'll run from
'Cause if you don't, you can just upload them to your website.
They're uploading already.
Okay.
Yeah. They usually don't. I don't bring my download.
We'll look down right now. Uploaded?
It's fairly new. Okay. How long has it started as soon as the race started? My discretion.
Are you playing with any of the stuff I gave you last time?
Yeah, I can get to the command line stuff. Just, you know, if there's a machine for dummies,
So Lucene, if you just go download it, has a lot of tutorials where you can, you know, index the thing, help files and stuff like that. And so that's how I learned it, was to play with that. There are lots of good books about Lucene. In fact, flabbergasted if it wasn't one called Lucene for Dummies, just a book, it's a self book. So, I can't recommend a specific one because I wasn't pretty much, but schedule notice. You want to have specific questions by the time you get to how it did.
Hey, is the library, the engineering library has a...
You're gonna get us arrested.
Oh,
sorry, you just got...
The engineering library's got, has some trouble seeing this picture.
Well, it depends on what you want to do. If you want to do something that requires Unix, I can set you up on a Unix server. If you want to do something that's based on the PC, like Java, you don't think you can actually control the screen. Then you're better off to do it on your own PC, get everybody's machine set up identically, Java's brush button most of the so you can just ship the giant files around.
Either way, I'm happy to set you up on a shared view.
I'm looking at the resource page. So INRI is a research system. INRI is open source. It's got a very small maintenance screen.
They're way more
fun. So gets much faster upgrading.
On one side, both colors end up with
different directions.
Okay, y'all are going to get me arrested if you keep bringing in things to drink, particularly one of them still. So, we should be eating and drinking like, or at least off camera.
The camera
only.
The microphones, on the other hand, I think that's pretty much everything.
Okay, so here's the setup. You've now got an idea that there are lots of interesting problems that arise when you try to search the web. So I want to pick one of them and show you how to solve it. Here's the problem. I know which pages are good. I know which pages match your query. You want good pages that match your query, right? Well, what do? Do I take the two scores and add them up and divide by two and hope for the best? Why not, right? I mean, we don't have any better ideas. So that's what we want to try to get away from. So here's how we're going to get away from it. In the vector space model, we ask, is this document relevant? And we get back an answer, sort of, right? I mean, you know, 0.86. Not really completely relevant, it's sort of relevant. We want to try to get a more formal model, so we're going to use probability theory. Here's how we do it. I ask you, is this document relevant? And you say, yes, no, or the probability that the answer is yes. Right? So you don't say, kinda, like it's a little bit relevant. You say, it's probably relevant. Right? Now, that sounds like an unnecessary distinction. But think about it this way. If you say it's probably relevant, like with probability 0.6, you have in mind that there are two things that might be, relevant or not. And the probability is 0.6 that it's relevant, and if it ain't relevant, then the not relevant, right? 0.4 not relevant, 0.6 relevant. That's what you mean when you say probably, as opposed to sort of, kind of. Right? Okay, so we're going to take that and try to formalize it, and I'll show you how we use it in information retrieval. So, jumping straight to the answer, we get this formula. The probability that this document, which we'll call the model of the document, the representation of the document, is appropriate given the query, is the probability that you would have guessed or you would have thought of that query if this was the document you were looking for. Right? So I show you the document, and you give me a query, and we'll see what's the probability you give me the query that I actually got. Right? The document that's most likely to give me the query is the one that I am most likely to be interested in. Right? Okay. But I have to combine that with the probability that this document is a good document. I combine it using multiplication. And I can do that because I have the PageRank score for the document. So I already know this number. I just have to tell you how to compute this number and this number. Now, this number is the probability you asked the query. You could have asked a lot of different stuff. What's the chance you'd ask this? I mean, you know, it's like Jennifer Lopez. It's got a really high probability, you know, and if it's like, you know, neutrino physics, it's got a really low probability, right? Not many people ask about neutrino physics, and you all know it. Search engine, you'll know how many people ask about Jennifer Lopez. Okay, so I can compute this just by looking at the queries. Hey, what's the chance that would happen? I can compute this from PageRank. I just have to tell you how to compute that and we're done. Now, you're looking at this and you're like, no. You got to tell me one more thing. Because I'm so intellectually curious. I want to know where the formula comes from, right? You can't just give me a formula.
We're done with that. I want to, like, do homework on this. You're willing to do that. But I feel morally obligated to explain to you where this formula comes from.
Because this isn't a formula somebody made up, right? You can actually prove that that is true from the first principles of probability theory. Okay? I'm not going to do that to you. You can actually do that very quickly. But instead, I just want to give you sort of the way of thinking of it. So here's how it works. The user has some information need, they imagine a document, and then they write down some queries. Right? That's the picture we're going to get. I have to now give you that with probability theory. So you've seen this picture before. Where does this come from? I'm building a comparison function for you, right? We're going to rank these things by probability. And the probability ranking principle is somebody who got famous for saying something really obvious. If you want to build a good ranked list, put the things that are more likely to be relevant higher up than the things that are less likely to be relevant. Didn't really need a name for that, did you? But anyway, they got one. Okay. So, you're not going to understand any of this until you master probability theory. So in the next 15 minutes, you're going to master probability theory. Here's an example you can think about. Imagine there's some really bad disease out there, like Ebola, right? Just turns your brains to mush. And the first symptom of Ebola is that you get a little tired at the end of a long class. So you're thinking, you go home tonight, and you're like, I'm coming down with Ebola. And so you go to see the doctor. Now, Ebola is a very rare disease. This isn't 1% of the people, not 1 in 100. This isn't 1 in 1,000. This is 1 in 10,000 people have Ebola. So the chance that the person sitting next to you had Ebola and gave it to you is pretty small. Right? You probably don't have Ebola, even if you're a little tired at the end of tonight's class. Okay? But you might. So you're thinking, I should go see the doctor and get a test. Fortunately, there's a very accurate test. This test is right 99% of the time. 99 times out of 100, it'll tell you the right thing. Yep? Okay. So you go get a test. Bad news, the test says you have Ebola. Now, how worried should you be? You just went and got a test for Ebola. The test is right 99% of the time, and Ebola kills you within 2 weeks.
Right? No final.
I would book that round the world trip, yeah? No final, no classes.
Yeah, yeah, if you live, then you know it as well.
What's that?
If you live 2 weeks, then you know
it. Then you know it was wrong, right? So why worry about it, right? You don't need to learn probability theory, just wait 2 weeks. Okay. Seriously, should you panic here?
No.
Why?
Because the error rate of the test is much higher than the probability of the total population who has it. So between the two probabilities, it is more likely that the test would give back a false positive than a true negative.
True positive. Is this book knowledge? I mean, or is this something that you'd be happy to tell someone else? Or is this something that if you walked in and got an Ebola test, and this 99% accurate test says you've got Ebola, you'd go, me. I mean, if it were you, would you feel any differently?
Of course.
Then you don't really believe in this probability theory stuff. Anybody have a question? A comment?
Doesn't it depend on when the test is wrong? Like, if the test is always wrong by reporting false negatives, then if you test positive, you should
had it, right?
Yes, it does. It does depend on the assumption you make about that. Okay, so here's a way of thinking about all of this. You want to find out the probability that you have the disease, given that you tested positive. So we read this symbol as given. Given that you tested positive, what's the probability you have the disease? That's what we want to know, right? Because I already told you the probability you have the disease if you didn't get a test. It's 0.01%. That's the probability you have the disease if you don't know anything. But now if you get the test, we want to know, what does this do to your knowledge of the probability you have the disease? Yes? You see how this is the right setup? Okay. Well, you know how rare the disease is and how accurate the test is. So what you do is you compute, if you want to know the probability you have the disease, given you tested positive, you calculate the probability that you tested positive, given that you have the disease. Right? Times the probability that you have the disease, not knowing anything, 0.01%, and divide that by the probability that you test positive. So we go out and we get all those numbers. So there's a 0.0001 probability times 0.99 is all this. Case two, you don't have the disease, is all this. Right? So case one and case two, this number comes from adding these two numbers. Thus, if you have the disease and you tested positive, you don't have the disease, you tested positive. Those are the only two possibilities, since I already told you, you tested positive. Right? So, now that we have this number, we can take the other two numbers we have, and we can compute the probability less than 1% you have the disease. So you shouldn't worry, even if it's you.
Right. I guess I don't really understand why the probability that you contracted it matters, because I would think if the test is 99% accurate, if you didn't contract it, then it's not going to say that. The test would seem to be, would seem to depend on the probability of your getting it.
Okay, so I have a test that's 99% accurate, mm-hmm. right? It will tell you if you're going to, let's see, imagine there's something that happens to nobody. Never happens to anybody. Okay? So the probability of it is zero. It can't happen. Right? Now I have a test. So it will tell you whether or not it's going to happen. And it's 99% accurate. Well, the one time it's not accurate, right? I mean, the one time it tells you that it's happening, it's telling you something impossible is happening. You're not going to believe it, are you?
No.
Just because you had a test. Right? You say, well, it must be the 1% because it's impossible. So you see, your prior knowledge combines with your test result to give you more knowledge. If you ignore the prior knowledge that it's impossible, you would draw the wrong conclusion. Right, so what if I ask you, what's the probability time is going to run backwards from around here? I've got a test for it. Right? Okay, my test is 99% accurate. Right? Okay, turns out my test says for you it's going to run backwards tomorrow. You're not going to believe me, are you? Because it's impossible. So it must be that other 1%. There's always that 1%, you know they say that?
Right. Well, but I mean, if you take something like that's, I'm not trying to be super argumentative here or anything, but I mean, say you take something that, like HIV, where it's not impossible that you get it, even if the odds are that, I mean, I know there's way more than there should be, but you can get it. If there's a test that I take and it's 99% accurate,
and it tells you you've got HIV,
I'm going to freak out. I mean,
that's because you didn't come to class tonight.
So the probability that you actually had HIV would presumably be much higher than the probability that you had no HIV, like 1 in 10,000.
Okay, so let's do HIV.
Okay, I think it's the same question. How did you get the 99% accuracy rating to your test if the occurrence in the population was? I can't rate the question. But how do you rate the test?
Good question.
Okay. In your time running backwards test, immediately kind of raise that question.
So there is a good question in how you get the accuracy test. There's a good question about whether both types of errors are equally likely. If we assume that we have this, and both types of errors are equally likely, then in a population of 1 million people, how many people are infected? Right? You can figure that out from the 0.001 business, right? And how many people are not infected? All those people, right? Okay. Now, of the infected people, how many of them tested positive? Well, it's a 99% accurate test, so we could reasonably guess that 99 of the 100 tested positive, right? And how many of them tested negative? One, right? Because it's got to add up to 100. Okay, out of these 999,900 that aren't, how many of them tested positive? Almost 10,000. How many tested negative? A whole lot, right? Well, these people don't have to worry too much because they're not
positive. But if it's the same test, then it should give the same result.
So if I give you a random person, you'll tell me the accurate answer 99 times and the wrong answer once. So take all these people, the ones are over here, the 99s are over there. Okay? Okay. So now I've got almost 10,000 people tested positive without having it, and 99 tested positive with having it. Yeah?
How does that change with the probability of the illness being 1 in a million or 10 in a million?
So you're saying if I change this so that there are more people over here and less over there?
No, I'm saying that in what we were discussing earlier, we were talking that the probability of this happening depends on the bigger world, on the probability of Ebola not being...
Right, that's what this is. In a population of 1 million people, what fraction would you expect to have Ebola? Or AIDS? Or colon?
But it's not gonna be different, hopefully.
Yes. Or some, right? So if I put more people over here, the only people who should worry are the people who tested positive and do have the disease, right? So 99 people should worry. And 9,999 should go to the beach, right? Because they don't have it. So what you said originally is right, that if we get this probability, badly mismatched with this probability, this always happens. So your intuition is telling you about the case where everything's equally likely. And now I run a test, and now I believe the result. But everything wasn't equally likely. One of these things almost never happens, and now I run a test, but the test isn't nearly as accurate as the skew in the distribution. So I get a very different actual outcome from what I would have intuitively expected. Does that make sense? It's a constructed example that's intended to show you what this means. Right? That formula can be interpreted in a way that makes sense of each of these probabilities. I just have to find some place to get this probability from, some place to get this probability from, some place to get this probability from. And if I have all of these, then I can compute that probability. And when that probability is high, I can show you the document. When that probability is low, I shouldn't. Make sense? Okay, so where do we get this probability? From Pedro. Okay? Where do we get this probability?
If you're sending the answer back, isn't that probability 1? They ask your query, that's why you give them that answer?
No. Now, people do ask more about Jennifer Lopez than about the train of
business.
What's
that? You analyze your circle.
That's what someone counts.
Okay, so let's say that I'm going to rank all the documents against a query, right? line of reasoning would be helpful to you at home. Let's say I'm going to rank all the documents for some query. So the query is going to be the same for every document, right? And what I want is I want to put the high numbers on top and the low numbers on the bottom, right? Now, if I want to compute the probability of the model of the document given the query, the probability that this document is appropriate to that query, I have to know this number. But look, this number is a probability. It's between 0 and 1, right? We don't know what it is, but it's something between 0 and 1. It's the probability. Okay, good. Let's assume that it's 0.2. Okay, so we get all whatever this is divided by 0.2. And then we get this score for some other document divided by 0.2. And for some other document divided by 0.2. We just took all the scores and divided them by 0.2. Right? Does that make sense?
So the piece of Q here, the probability that they asked the query?
The probability that that query was asked to this number. So if this number turns out to be 0.2, we're just going to take the scores we computed this way, we're going to divide them all by 0.2, and then we're going to sort. So the big ones before we divided are going to be the big ones after we divide, right? Because we divided them all by 0.2. With me? Okay. We're no longer computing the probability. If I want to know the probability, I have to divide by 0.2. But I'm just going to skip dividing by 0.2 because I don't really care what the probability is.
Didn't we run into this problem when we were doing the vector computations? Where you said, I'm off here, but you said that it doesn't matter what you divide by when you're, was it when you're normalizing? Or
you don't have to normalize by the query.
Because you're dividing everything.
Because everything's normalized by the same query length, right? So. There's a scary sort of eerie similarity between all these things and all those things because in the end, on the very last slide, they're the same thing. But we're just sneaking up on it another way. Okay? So yeah, this is exactly the same as not having to normalize by the query length. This thing is the same for every document as long as I don't change the query. I'm trying to rank things for the query, right? So I can just ignore it. Yeah? Okay, good. So we'll get rid of that. I just need this and this. This comes from PageRank, and I have to tell you where to get that from. And we're done. Right? So I have to tell you the probability that you would have thought of this query if that was the document you wanted. Right? Okay? Even easier. Half the horrible disease. Now, let's say that we speak English. And I show you these sentences. A quick brown dog. Say, right? Okay. Dog quick or brown? Which one of those is better? First one, the first one's not very good, right? I mean, it's a bastardization of a quick brown fox. But still, it's probably. Okay. How about this one here?
Wish
that
I have brown dog.
What's that?
Wish that I have brown dog.
What does it mean?
Quick
Okay. Is that English?
No, that's Russian.
Well, that's Russian, but that looks like English. So this is more like English than this one. Right? And this is more like English than this one. And this is more like English than this one, right? So if I want to know which one's English, all I have to do is find some way of figuring out what the probability is. That's English, that's English, that's English. And then I can use those probabilities under some assumptions to calculate this order. Right? Okay, very good. So, let's just say that the word the is spoken in English 2 times out of every 10. 2 words out of every 10 English words are the. One word out of 10 is a. Man only occurs 1 time in 100. woman one time at 100 said, so on and so forth, right? So let's just say, look at a, you know, a lot of the Wall Street Journal, and this is what I see. Okay? Then I just say, what's the probability that somebody says the man likes the woman? And I'm like, well, it's this, and this, and this, and this, and that. Right? That's the probability that somebody would say that. That gets pretty stupid. It assumes that I don't know anything about what order these words are likely to occur. Right? But I can now tell you the probability that's. Does that have a familiar ring to it? So that's how you compute it, right? Yeah.
But if a person says the woman, man likes the, it would be the same.
Same score.
So in the previous slide, how come like you showed that P1 is greater than P2, right? A quick brown dog is more English than dog quick a brown. How can you say that?
Yeah, well, okay. We couldn't have computed that. You have to pay attention to P1. Good tip. Okay. So where that comes from is that I assume that every word that could ever be said is sitting here in my urn. Why people do probability like urns? It's in my bucket, right? Okay, so I got all the words in my bucket, and I want to know the probability that these got pulled out. Right, so that's the, and that's also the, and you can see I got a lot of the's in there, and less of some other words, right? So that's what my bucket looks like. So I just find out the probability of those things got pulled out, and I just multiply those probabilities, right? Okay?
Is this the probability of the phrase, or the probability that those words will occur next to each other?
Next to each other. Okay? Now, here I've got the Wall Street Journal, and here I've got the New York Times. Well, but anyway, you can get it. Well, whatever. Yeah, so like Jan gets fed more in the New York Times than you expect. This is Shakespeare, okay? And here's the Wall Street Journal. So the Wall Street Journal doesn't say this very often, but the Shakespeare does. Okay? Okay. Now, I find here the class pleases Jan Maiden. Okay? So now I can do a computation and I can find out that I'm more likely to have said that sentence if I'm Shakespeare than if I'm the Wall Street Journal. Yes? And do you remember what I told you? That what we're trying to do is we're trying to find the probability that we would generate a query given the documents. Remember what we're trying to do? Well, where do I get the language model? From the documents. How do I learn about Shakespeare? Shakespeare's A, right? Let's stop modeling Shakespeare. Let's model one of Shakespeare's documents. Let's model one of the New York Times documents. And then let's compute the probability that the query came from the New York Times. As opposed to the probability. Got it? See where it comes from? So it's just this simple multiplying altogether. Okay? So I just build a model for every document. I rank the documents based on the probability of the model given the query times the probability, if I have it, of the model in the first place from PageRank. If I don't have it, I just assume it's one, the same for everyone, and we're done. We've got all the pieces. Okay. More details, many, many more details. We'll come back to that. But I want to get to the semantic question. It turns out that most of the stuff that's on the web isn't on the web. It has to be generated dynamically. So people call this the East Web. They're pages that come out of databases, and Crawley won't find them. And this is the startling statistic. There's two interesting things about this. One is that there is a lot more of this than there is the crawlable web. Now, I looked at that number the first time, and I was like, oh, come on. That can't be true. Right? I mean, this stuff's not in the Washington Post every day. If it were 500 times bigger than the web, we'd have heard of it, right? So what is it? Well, here it is. It's all the data NOAA has about, I think you've heard of this global warming thing.
Yeah?
Okay. All the data they use to include that. In every photograph ever taken of the Earth, right? By any satellite. Like, okay, so you can see how it's bigger than the web? Here's how much bigger. This is 2003. So here's everything in print in 2003. In place. Here's everything in the public web in 2003. There's everything in the deep web in 2003. And then, just to make the point, I'll do it over here. Look at this. This is, these things are in terabytes. So there's a 1 terabyte, a 10 terabytes, a 100 terabytes, a 1,000 terabytes, 10,000 terabytes. So you see the scale is, it's just an awful lot of stuff out there. So that's one iteration. Now here's the second interesting thing. All of these things that are out there, we know an awful lot about because they're not in information retrieval systems. They're in databases. We know where the picture was taken. We know when the picture was taken. We know what the design of the camera was. We know where the picture stored. We know how big the picture is. We know what angle they were looking at. We know what time of day it was. And when we serve it up to you over the web, we throw all that stuff away and just give you the picture. So we know an awful lot about this that we throw away. So we have almost all the information in the world. That surface web and all that print stuff is small. We have almost all the information in the world. All that information has got rich relationships, and we're going to ignore the information and the relationships and pretend to be searching on your behalf. Right?
Yeah. They have slides. They're not going to use them quite as much of a structure for me to follow. It's more so you've got a little thing when I'm done so you can look at it. Remember all the fancy work that I use. So I'm Jen Goldman. I'm a professor here in the system professor, and I did my PhD here in computer science at College Park, and I postdoc, and I just loved it so much that Dr. Orr said I should apply for it, and I did, and so now I'm here forever. So I worked in the semantic web lab here on campus with Jim Hendler, who's one of the guys who invented the semantic web, and he left and I stayed, and now I'm the head of the semantic web lab. And if any of you are fascinated with it and interested in doing research, you should come and talk to me because I also have fun projects to go on. So the semantic web. So the web, regardless of what you just heard, started in 1991, as far as I'm concerned, because that's when all of the stuff was invented that allowed it to happen. And I don't know, I started using the web in like 1994, kind of little. And I went to college in 95, I was a freshman in college, and I remember like they deleted the link to the search engine from the university homepage that came up when we got on the lab computers, and so then like I couldn't use the web, right, because I just knew that you had to click on that link. And at one point I even had a directory of the web, which was like a phone book, and it listed all the web pages in it, which was awesome. Right, that was 1994. They could just look small in there. And if you look at how the web has evolved, so most of you have been, most of you are about my age. I'm still about the same age as everybody in these classes. You remember using the web, and it's gotten better, right? There was a little while that it got kind of bad, but it's gotten better. And if you go into the Internet Archive, you all know the Internet Archive? Okay. If you go there and you look at some old versions of pages, they're really nasty, and they've gotten better.
if you look at the evolution of the web, like we've been talking about from 1991 to now, and all of the evolution of the technology has really existed to make pages more accessible and understandable by people. So how many of you know HTML? Probably all have done it at some point. Okay, so in HTML, we know that there's tags, and you look at the tags, and you can see that they originated for formatting like academic papers, right? There's heading tags, and there you can put in links and horizontal rules, and it's stuff that looks like if you were labeling sections of a document, right? And that's what it was for formatting documents. And then we got the ability to put in images and inline images with a textograph around it. I remember my first web class, which was still a huge idea. If you made five, you could have inline images, everyone was all excited. Right, and then there was sort of this bad diversion into frames, right? Everybody loved frames for a while, and then everybody realized frames are really terrible, and they kind of went away. But the idea behind it was good, and that sort of preserved. And then they separated out the styles from the main structure of the document. You got style sheets, you can do all these fancy things. So the presentation of things is now pretty good. It used to be that it was kind of hard to even read stuff on the web. But now pretty much all the time you go to a page, it's laid out and structured in a way that we can understand what's there. So that's great. The problem is, as we've done that, it's gotten harder and harder for computers to understand what's on those pages. So text is one thing, but now we've got all these images, video. We've got a lot of flash-based sites, right? The Home Star Runner, right? You guys watch this, most of you guys see this. So you can't index anything from the Home Star Runner, right? Because every single thing on there is a flash. And it's also video, right? So you have people talking, and that's not text. There's no text anywhere, even if you could get into the flash and get the content out of it. Okay, and then we talked about, you saw these slides on the deep web. There's all these databases. So you go to Amazon and you search for something. You go to Google and search for something. There's no permanent page that has the Google search results for broccoli, right? It just changes. They go to their database and they give you new results from the search. So there's all this data back there that a computer can't understand. So this is compounded by the fact that the data is sometimes in different places. So here's the example that I always give. Say you want to find a song that was on the Billboard Top 10 that has a cowbell in it. Okay. I don't know if you know one off the top of your head. That doesn't count. You search for it. Okay, so how do you find this? You want to find an MP3 of this song. Right, not just the name of the song, but download an MP3. So, can you find songs with cowbells? There's a website dedicated to songs that feature cowbells. If you look, you'll find it. Okay, so there's a website that has that. Every song that has a cowbell is listed on this website. And then you obviously can find all these billboards, historical billboard top 10. There's lots of pages that have those. And it's easy on the web to find MP3, legal or otherwise. Right? So the data's all out there, and this is even data that we can say computers can kind of understand it, right? We can say this is a list of MP3s, this is a list of songs, this is a list of songs. Put them all together, right? But that doesn't happen because the list of cowbell songs on one site and the list of billboard songs is on another site, and the MP3s are on another site. And even if you have hyperlinks like ahref equals links, that data doesn't all come together. Right, Google can't do that search for you because it would need data from a bunch of different places. And so this idea of having a computer understand the information that's hidden behind the web pages, understand its relationships to one another, and looking at it as a whole thing, right? It's not a bunch of pages, it's not a bunch of documents, it's just a bunch of ideas that are all connected together, and it doesn't matter where they live on the web. That's the idea behind the semantic web. So this idea started really out of some projects here at College Park, and then through DARPA. So, let's see, late 90s, Jim Hendler, who was a professor here at College Park, went to DARPA and started this project called DAML, the DARPA Agent Markup Language, which pulled on some ideas that his students had been working on for modeling in a machine processable way the content that people had on their web pages. And the original idea was you sort of stuck some stuff up in the header section of your HTML page that said, in some way the computer could understand the stuff that was on your page. So that led to this project at DARPA, and that left DARPA, and when I came here to do my PhD in 2001, there was this word, the semantic web, but there was no such thing. So web stuff kind of exists as a web thing when it's part of a standard generally out of the World Wide Web, which is Tim Berners-Lee now has it, and they moved out of CERN, and now they're at MIT. There's a bunch of weird guys up there, and there's big argumentative meetings where people bicker about what should be in HTML and what should be in style sheets and what should be in the semantic web. And so they bickered and bickered, and I bickered with them for years and years. And then in 2003, I guess, maybe early 2004, we sort of officially got recommendations for the semantic web languages that allowed you to represent this information. So the semantic web has really been around for, you know, 3 or 4 years at this point. So what I'm going to give you are kind of the basics of what exists in the semantic web, what the parts are, kind of what it does. And hopefully that'll give you an idea of the vision. I'm going to leave out all the nasty technical bits that aren't fun for anybody, including me, even though I did research on it. I left those parts of the class. Okay? So we got kind of the idea, right? Model the data in a way the computers can process. It's not fun for people to look at this stuff. The computers can process it. I'm going to skip around a little bit. So how do we represent this information? At its core, it's based on XML. You all know XML, right? Tag. That's it. Then there are all of these kind of languages that follow. So SHU was here at Maryland. DEML was the DARPA Asian markup language. OIL was the European version. And then we all got together, nice and happy, and we made the wonderfully named DEML plus OIL, which is terrible. And so then we moved to standardize these things. We have RDF, the Resource Description Framework, RDFS, the RDF schema, and OWL, the web ontology language. But OWL was nice, it was WOL. So the web ontology language, OWL. You use a lot of these languages without knowing it. So how many of you subscribe to RSS feeds for blogs? How many people know what an RSS feed is? Okay. So for the few of you who don't know, if you look at a blog, you'll see this little orange icon up in the corner by the URL. It's got some white lines on it. And if you click on it, you can subscribe. And what that does is basically hooks your computer up to this little XML file. And if you have the right plugin in your browser, you can just click a button and it'll tell you when the person has updated their blog. So if you read 50 blogs, you don't have to go to all 50 to see if they're updated. You just click the button and it gets those little XML files, which are actually formatted with RDF, and it tells you if they've been updated or not. Okay. So RDF lets you describe some of these things. RDFS gives you some more expressivity on top of RDF, and OWL gives you more expressivity on top of that. So I'm probably going to mention these languages as I go through the structure, and I wanted to give you that first. Okay, basically, it's just stuff on top of XML that lets you say these expressions. It's all on the web. Okay, ontology. You guys are in a sort of library place. Have you heard of ontology? Thesauruses? Okay. Okay, so ontologies are kind of the core technology of the semantic web. And you can kind of think of ontologies as a collection of classes and properties. You've dealt with these before. So a taxonomy would count as an ontology. You did that in biology class in my elementary school. You have animals, and then there are animals, you have vertebrates and invertebrates, and under vertebrates you have mammals and birds and whatever else. Right? So that's a taxonomy. Each one of those things would be a class. So a class of things called animals, you have a subclass called vertebrates. You have a subclass of vertebrates called mammals. You have a subclass of mammals called dogs. Those are all classes, and you can put them in a structure like that. And then you can have instances. This is my dog, hi. Okay, she's an instance of the class of things called dogs. All right, so without even getting to any of the other details, say all we have are classes and class hierarchies, and then instances of those classes. And so I write this in this XML form. There's animals and vertebrates and mammals and dogs. And here's Ty, my dog, an instance of that class. Okay, so we've got that. The computer can understand that. So now I want to do a search. Right now, if you look at my web page, because I do have a web page for my dog, Pi, you want to search for it, you can search for dog and Pi, and it'll come up. Okay. What if you want to do a search for animals? Show me a page to talk about animals. You'll never, even if you go to every single Google search result for animals, you'll never find a paper talk about my dog pie, because it doesn't say animal on there anywhere, right? But if you have this structure that says dogs are mammals, are vertebrates, are animals, you can infer, right, use some logic. You took a philosophy class in the logic, you used science in the logic. Use some of this logic, and you can infer that pie is an animal, she's also a vertebrate, she's also a mammal, because you know she's a dog, and they're in a structure like that together. Okay, this is called reasoning. I mean, just like it is, it's not a special semantic web term. But this kind of reasoning is an important part of the semantic web. There's very advanced reasoning that you can do on the semantic web. I'm not going to give you all of it today. But that's one thing that lets the computer access all sorts of other kinds of data for you. Right? So you can take a database, you can take your database schema, turn your schema into an ontology for your classes. We're going to get to the properties, the relationships between things. Use that schema from your database to be an ontology on the semantic web. And then all the data in your database are instances of your ontological structure. Basically, it's exactly the same thing you do in the database. And you stick it all on the web in an XML file. And then it's accessible by computers on the web because they can understand XML and they understand the structure of your ontology. You already get something from this class hierarchy, but the next thing, in addition to classes, you get properties. And properties are relationships between objects. So I Jen am a person, I'm an instance of the person's class. This is my dog Pi. And Jen owns Pi. Owns is a property. The relationship between two objects, two instances that we know. Okay? So that's it. You have classes, you have properties, you have instances. We're done. That's the semantic web. Right? So what kind of reasoning can you do with properties? Very simple reasoning. You can have domains and ranges. So you could say, people eat food. Okay, so you have this property eat connects people and food. And so you can say the domain of eat is people, which means only people can eat things, and the range of eat is food. So that you can only eat food, you can't eat anything that's not food. Chairs, voila. Okay, so then if I say Jen eats broccoli, you know that Jen is a person and broccoli is food, because we know that only people eat things and they only eat food. So those are the sort of inferences that you can make. So when you put a document on the semantic web, you have any combination of these things, classes, properties, and instances. People tend to separate them, where they'll have one file with the classes and the properties, the definitions. So here's all of my classes, animals, vertebrates, mammals, dogs, people. Here's all the properties, owns and eats, which are clear. Okay? And that goes up there. Okay, and then you have a separate file that says pie is dog, Jen is person, Jen is pie, Jen is broccoli. So it's that instance data goes in a separate file. Okay? So you talked about classes. These are some slightly more technical slides. You don't have to get all of those things. Instances. So there's our languages. Okay? We talked about these languages. So RDF basically just lets you describe things on the web and RDFS lets you do these domain ranges, say a little bit more about class hierarchies. And OWL lets you say all sorts of crazy things. So you could say, people eat food, but vegetarians eat vegetarian food. And I'm going to define vegetarian food to be the intersection of all things that are food and the complement of meat. Right? Gut operations and things. Very expressive, very hard to reason over. You don't need to know all these details. Right? If you want to, you can find the document online. The web ontology languages, you'll get all the stuff that you can say there. Okay, so those are our languages. So we have those, and I've kind of been talking you through the structure of information on the semantic web. It's all done in these things called triples. A subject, a predicate or a property, and an object. So, say Jen owns pie, Jen is the subject, owns is the predicate, the object is pie. Okay? We can kind of draw this as a graph, right? Here's a node for Jen, here's a node for Pi, here's an edge that connects them, and we'll label that home. Okay, so this makes what's called an RDF graph, and we'll see a picture of one. Okay, so triples are cool with triples. So makes sense. So you always have subject, predicate, object. And then the most important thing is URIs, which is just a superset of URLs. We all know what these are, just a web address. Okay, so we're just talking about web addresses for documents.
Right, but you also, so most of you said you know HTML, and if you haven't done HTML, you've probably seen this. So like you go to a frequently asked questions page, and you click on a question, it jumps you down the page. And if you look up at the address, you'll see it's like the page, and then a pound sign, and then some other word. Right, you all have seen this? Okay, so this is linking you to like part of the page. Okay, on the semantic web, you'll have a document, and it goes up there on the semantic web. And then you can link to any object defined in that document by doing the name of the document and a pound sign and then the name of the object. So you could have, you know, here's Jen's ontology, www.jensontology.owl. That's going to be the document. And if you do pound Jen, it's going to take you to the thing called Jen in that document. So you can refer to any object, any piece of data on the semantic web with a unique URI. Okay? URI of the document, the name of the thing, the name has to be unique for everything. Just like if you're linking to the middle of the page, each of those names of things has to be unique. So everything on the web gets a unique address, a unique URI. This is critically important for the semantic web to work. You can talk about anything that way. So if we go back to our example, I want to find an MP3 of a song that was on the Billboard Top 10 that features the cowbell. Okay. So you have three sites. The MP3 site, the Billboard site, the cowbell site. Okay? So our cowbell site could say, here's a list of all these songs, all the classic things, songs with cowbells. Right? So we could say, this song features instrument is our property, cowbell is the value, right? Say it in the circle. There's a bunch of ways that you can do that. So the cowbell site is going to say that, but let's say it's not going to make up its own URI, its own identifier for every song. It's going to use the popular one. Just like if you're linking to a movie, say, oh, I went to see Vampires this weekend. It's not going to link to like some random guy's page about vampires, right? It's probably linked to the IMDb. So if you're making this site about songs with cowbells, you'll use whatever the official site is that lists every song ever made. Right? You're going to say, okay, that song, the URI for that song, which isn't defined on my site, it's defined on theirs, but here's the URI for it, it's unique, features this instrument called a cowbell. Okay, so now we have data from two places, the song place and the cowbell place together. The cowbell place can say whatever they want about the songs that are defined in that other place. Okay, so then we've got the Billboard place, and maybe they're the official ones with the song name, maybe it's iTunes, but they're going to say, here's the Billboard Top 10 list from this year. We have an object, Billboard Top 10 list. It has a date as a property, it has a number one song as a property, a number two song as a property, lists all the songs, right? Those songs are identified by their URIs, which hopefully will be the same as the cowbell one. And if they're not, you can actually do some mapping to put them together. Say, oh, the Billboard song, you know, Walk Like an Egyptian, looking for the cowbell, is the same as this site's song called Walk Like an Egyptian. Those are the same. And a semantic web reasoner can say, oh, they're the same. I'm going to make those URIs equivalent to one another. So anytime somebody talks about one, I know they're talking about the other. Okay, so now we've merged that data together. So I want to find something that features the instrument cowbell, which was on one site, and that was on the Billboard Top 10, which we can get kind of by looking at that other site. Those things are connected. And now I want to find MP3s. Right? So you can say this is the MP3 for this song, for this triple. MP3, four songs, whatever. Okay? Using the same URIs or mapping them together, that gets built into one big graph. And this is the thing that the semantic web has to do that search engines kind of don't have to do. Right? The semantic web relies on doing this reasoning, merging these URIs together, and building this big knowledge model. One of the research challenges for the semantic web is if you want to pose a query over the reasoned knowledge model, all these things put together, same things mapped to each other, you've done the reasoning so all the dogs are also mammals and vertebrates and animals. That reasoning is really hard, but that's a huge knowledge base, right, to store. It's a problem that we haven't had to deal with too much yet because the semantic web is pretty new. But we can't even deal with all the data that's on the semantic web now. There's too much. So it's definitely a problem, but assuming we can do it, you get this big unified knowledge model, and now you can pose queries about whatever you want to it. Because all these things from all these different sites are easily merged together.
Whereas if you did it with just text, like hypertext, first you wouldn't know what the MP3 was a song of, right? Because that's not there. And you wouldn't know that, you know, a phrase on one site matches a phrase on another site. But the URIs let us put it together, and we can do that. So it's a little thing, right? It's just a web address. But it's critically important for being able to put things in different documents on different websites together. So, another part of this is just nice. All of these languages are standardized, all the reasoning is standardized, and that's done with the World Wide Web Consortium. And if you go to wp3.org, you can find descriptions of all this stuff. So, here's a sample of a tiny RDF graph. It's really tiny. Most of them are just big blobs, because there's so much data, right? My research area is in social networks. So if you take all the social networks on the web, which have 20 million profiles, 20 million people, and then all sorts of information about them, and all their connections to everybody else from a bunch of different websites, you just try to get 20 million dots on the screen and you can't see what's going on, right? So this is really a tiny little graph on the semantic web, but each square or oval represents an object. So pi the dog, or me, or broccoli. And each edge is a property of it, connecting it to something else. So we can't really read the text on here. But we can say, here's Jen, and she owns this dog pie, and she eats this with broccoli. And broccoli is a vegetable, and it contains a vitamin C. And vitamin C is a really great vitamin for preventing colds. Right? Each edge here is a property connecting it to another object. And these can come from all sorts of different pages. So maybe some of this data here is from my site. This may still be on my site, but this data is someplace else. Right? It all gets pulled together into this graph. So your algorithms for working with this, the way you actually searched it, is a little bit different than if you're working with a traditional database, because you really just have one big table with three fields, subject, price, and object. Subject, price, and object. So there's actually different kinds of databases for handling this multiple stores that let you take advantage of some of the structure, do some more efficient stuff on it compared to how you work with normal databases. You can imagine searching this is a little different than searching just text. Right? You can't just put in a phrase if you're searching the semantic web. So if you want to find a cowbell, you don't just type in cowbell. Right? You have to have the URI for the concept of the thing called cowbell. Right? Because I could call the thing about cowbell something else. I could call it that in French or in German or in Russian. It doesn't matter because it's the same concept everywhere. But you just need to know the concept here. Do you have a question? So it's like an authority file, sort of. So you can have that. So you could have an authoritative URI for the concept cowbell. But you don't have to. I mean, things work nicely if you've kind of gotten authoritative ones, but you don't have to. It tends to go this way. So like you said, there's all the social networking stuff. When people have to talk about people, they generally use that concept. But you can have lots of, like I say, I don't like their definition of person. I'm making up my own. And in fact, I can explicitly say it's different from theirs. And use my own. That works fine, too. It just makes some of these things a little bit more difficult. And if you want to do it, so if you have a site and you're like, she says they're different, I'm going to ignore that, I'm going to say they're the same, then you have to do what's called mapping between the two ontologies. That person that everybody's using is the same as this person that she's using all the time. Did you want to jump in there?
Did you mean the name authority file? When you said authority file, I mean...
Yeah, sure. Well, I was thinking of like a Library of Congress, like subject heading, or name authority file, that if I say that Doug Ward authored this, I'm talking about you and not somebody else who happens to have a similar name who spelled it Douglas, or that the same concept has to be linked to a sort of uniform type of URI.
The way that this works from what I've been saying is that you assume that he could have, you know, there's an instance for him, right, an instance of the concept, and his name could be Doug Ward or Douglas Ward or all of the above, you could have all of his pseudonyms on there. But you have one URI that refers to him, to all of them.
Right.
Right.
Okay. Wouldn't that become a muse, say, 20 years from now?
Is it? Really absolutely. And it's kind of unwieldy now, doing this mapping. Because you get people who, like, would totally use the standard, but they don't know what it is. right? I mean, if I told all of you, make a semantic web file, here's a tool, you wouldn't know to go find the folk ontology that talks about people and use that, right? You just make your own. So the problem of mapping one is really hard. The concepts don't quite match in the zip code and the postal code. They're not really the same thing, but they're kind of the same thing. So you just say that they're equivalent, or if not, how do you map them together? That problem is really hard, and it's one that is hard enough that even people doing PhDs in this space, if I have a student that says I want to do ontology mapping, I say, why don't we try something else for you to do? Because it's really hard. And I mean, you imagine a huge semantic web, right? Not just representing the data, but the ontology, that big. And trying to handle that, it definitely gets unwieldy. So what you end up doing, what people end up doing for building systems like this, massive building system like this, National Cancer Institute has a system like this, is that all of their critical concepts, they define themselves. So they kind of make what they consider an authoritative set of definitions. The National Cancer Institute had one of the first ontologies on the web that I helped them build, and it's gigabytes, right? Every disease they know of, every drug they know of, every treatment, just everything is in there. And they use that as their standard vocabulary, and they call it a vocabulary. Because it's produced by an official organization, a lot of people who are talking about cancer are going to refer back to that. But absolutely can be a case that, you know, I decide I'm going to just make up my own cancer terms. I don't understand theirs. Yeah, and then working with it, trying to find those equivalencies is very hard to do automatically. So yeah, I mean, this, you've identified a real problem.
So if we're trying to make an object-oriented internet, doesn't that mean we're actually making an internet, a web that understands?
Yes, and that's the core.
And to do that, don't we need humans and things and these proxies?
Yes.
We actually need the humans who create that.
You absolutely need humans generating the data, humans generating the ontologies, humans doing the mapping. So the idea is that the computer is going to be able to do some reasoning for you in the first place. So if you want to do this cowbell industry example, you're going to have humans creating all of that data, but the computer is going to be able to look at all of it, bring it together, and kind of find these patterns in what's going to be billions and billions of nodes up here to give you the information.
Is it possible? Are there, I mean, did anyone say, well, I want to see if we actually can?
So it can work in theory. I come from a school where we said, that's just fine in practice, but how does it work in theory? But kind of flipping it around. It absolutely can work in theory. There are some challenges. So you brought up one, right? There's just being able to map these things together. Okay, the mapping problem is one. There's also a speed problem. So this reasoning that I'm talking about that's so important is sort of one of the hardest known problems in computer science. It's really so difficult that if you had to do it in the worst case, it would take longer than the lifetime of the universe. So if you want to do something like, say, news streaming, so I get lots of news feeds coming in and I only want the ones about broccoli, right, and investing in broccoli, to actually process each of those and reason about it and get it, that's a PhD level problem. So there's a lot of challenges to being able to do this, but in theory it'll work. It needs a lot more work. 3 years. We've only been doing it for 3 years. Before he starts, do you have another question?
I have a straightforward practical question and an answer to a thoughtful question. Straightforward practical question is, I guess when you see something like this, you think, yeah, okay, you're creating concepts. Good luck. But is there a sense where it doesn't have to be comprehensive that you're, are you actually seeing a benefit? You know, you're getting a positive return on just getting some of these connections created to the network where we, you don't actually have to have a matrix of all human knowledge connected before
That's
you
right.
start getting a payoff.
That's right. So, Jim Kindler, my advisor, I'm trying to think of what he had a little catchphrase about this. A little bit of linking uses to these benefits. It was much catchier than that. It's an open world assumption. So we absolutely assume we don't know everything. There are people that try to do that. The common sense reasoning people try to model all of human knowledge and then they figure the computer,
right.
If they know all that, they'll just become self-aware. I don't buy that. I think that's kind of crazy. There are people that think that. But the semantic web is not that. It's really just represent what we know. Basically make all of this data that's sort of in databases a little more accessible on the web so computers can deal with it.
Probably not going to replace the quick and dirty Google type approach to
Yeah, the thing is, Google works really well for text.
Yeah.
Right? It doesn't work so well for images or video. You could do a sort of knowledge modeling, a little RDF file that would say, this is a video of the president that was taken on this day in this location, and by the way, that location is linked to this file that gives you the weather data, and the president is linked to this file which describes all of the world leaders and maybe who his ancestors were. You could say, find me a descendant of this person in a video that was taken when it was snowing, you know, find that video of Clinton Davis.
You can ask the question, we may not be able to give you the answer.
All right. It looks like what you're recreating your same logic, and which depends upon essences, which was thrown out by Galileo. Modern science, which would make all this possible. Does that trouble you at all?
Just out of the comment.
Fair enough.
I'll just question, the people doing this research, are they paying attention to classical philosophy and the difference between classical philosophy and modern?
So there are some philosophers doing work in this space, and they tend to be generally unproductive because they think about these questions. And so, I don't dismiss them as irrelevant, but on a practical level, from a computer science perspective, we're just representing information in XML and supporting some basic first-order logic, a subset of first-order logic, which is a lot simpler than having to deal with these nasty things we don't understand. You know, it's symbol manipulation, it's set theory and symbols. We can handle that part. And look, it works. So who cares about us?
It works.
Yeah.
Okay, very good. Thank you. You were delightful. Skeptical. So you get your chance now at being skeptical. You take a break. I saw that question. You take a break and come back in 5 minutes. And do a semantic web visioning exercise. So during the break, I want you to think about where you want to be in this. The goal is to link ontologies in ways that help systems to reason on behalf of users. So some of you are going to link ontologies, and some of you are going to reason on behalf of users. The process is you pick some related ontologies that you know of, or if you don't know of an ontology, just pick one up. Have to make up more than one, actually. And then pick some general approach for doing something. That's on the next page. And then work out the details. Here are the tasks. So there'll be 6 teams, 24 people in class, 4 people in a team. 3 people are good guys, 1 person is evil. You can try to solve the flash self-description problem. Or you can try to solve the dog animal problem. If you had some ontology, how would you use it to improve your search? Aren't you a little worried that dogs are used to batten down hatches and those are not animals? You could start a description service if you're entrepreneurial. You could have your digital library describing things that your customers might need. Sort of a magic web cataloging. You could get some professional ontologists. Now, note these are not oncologists. These are ontologists together and form a company and put together some ontologies in your company. You could figure out how many dollars it's going to cost you for ontology link. Or you could be a cheapskate and get all the retired catalogers building in Florida and organize their efforts using web service. Or you could make it into a game, see who can link ontologies the best. Right? You get a prize, you get a higher score. Just to give you an example, we're going to have all the retired catalogers living in Florida technique. So you're going to get together in a group of 3 people, 3 good people, and you're going to figure out how to do this. So what kind of things do we need to show you? What kind of browsers do we need to support? What kind of people do we need to recruit? How do we need to vet these people? And then we're going to have the 4th evil person sitting here figuring out how to stack the deck. How to put people in that want their particular links built into the ontology, so everything links to porn, for example, or whatever it is they're trying to sell. And so you'll have a chance to work in your groups to see how hard it is in the presence of an adversary to make progress. So that's the goal. 5-minute break. Be back at 26 and 10 seconds after. And then we'll go for 15 minutes of this, and we'll have a quick wrap discussion of main lessons learned, not a complete description of everything that you talked about, but you know, a one takeaway message I never thought of, blah. Right. Or I'm now convinced more than ever about blah. Okay, see you in 5 minutes.
Yes, there is a...
Of course.
Oh,